Hey everybody, I'm Chris.
Hey, I'm Bill.
Have you ever asked yourself, what is your superpower?
Everyone has a superpower. Most people just don't know what it is.
We're going to help you uncover it.
This podcast is all about helping people figure out what their truly unique superpower is.
Superpowers, what's yours?
Hello and welcome to another episode of Superpowers Podcast. We're in for a treat today, ladies and gentlemen. We have with us Mr. David Kidder.
David, welcome to the Superpowers Podcast Show. You like hearing our, I can tell you're excited to hear our voices.
I'm super excited. It's kind of fantasy of mine to spend an hour with you guys talking about whatever we're going to talk about. Yes.
So David, this is the first, you're the first guest post my birthday present to Bill, which was back a few weeks ago, which was actually for Bill, but kind of for me as well.
Yeah.
It's like a dual birthday.
It's one of those gifts that it's like really for yourself, but right. You kind of give it to somebody else.
Yeah. I like it. So we're going to christen this superpower.
It's spelled correctly too, which is good.
It looks great.
I love it.
David, so happy to have you here. The last time I believe we all spent time, the three of us spent time together, may have been back in December over some lunch and some cocktails for the holidays at Balthazar.
Our annual
lunch. Do we talk about that or just jump?
That's up to you. It's a
great luncheon,
like
but that was the last time we saw each other.
Yes, that was. It always ends well, begins well, but definitely ended well this year.
Yeah, no pen tattoos on this one. We all kind of walked out relatively.
Domain names. We did pretty well, actually.
Unscathed.
Well, that's a lunch where I think we skip right over it because we all were bound by silence of that. You know, there's a confidentiality clause that's not written but understood. 100%. That what happens at that lunch stays at that lunch.
It must.
And it works. Yeah, it works. We did have that lunch last year where we had a few more guests come in and we felt that was maybe threatened.
Yeah, it wasn't intimate enough.
And we brought it back.
Yeah, we have to bounce, gotta fillet at the edges because it's very real.
So, David, so you're stuck with us now, and I know one thing about you from our breakfast at the Marinette Diner or whatnot, that you obviously have a high case of ADD that you do talk about. You don't have your device. And so I was actually, when you threw your phone there a minute ago, is that before Bill came in, I was actually curious to see how you were going to do concentrated and focused here, but you're
I'm pretty chill. I'm trying not to tap my feet or move. Okay. Or, I don't want to jiggle because I was saying to Bill, not sure which side is the fat side of the table, but apparently both are for me. So I just
it's that side and this side. The only skinny side is the skinny guy.
Boom. So
maybe you could match your sweater with a wall.
I know. Well, this is you should see how much attention to detail goes into to the clothing and the hair gel. David, we've known each other for quite some time, and we're going to talk a little bit about you and your family and Bionic, and the fact that the one thing I still can't understand is how somebody writes so many. Bill, how many books have you written in your life?
One, actually.
Yeah, Billy Blockchain has written a book?
I've written a book, and actually I went to Kidder to be like, hey, I wrote this great book.
Yeah.
I need to get it published. And he was like, oh, you got to talk to my team.
Yeah.
So. And his team came back and was like,
it was my agent.
Yeah, sounds interesting. Not interested.
Well, that's always been one of the most impressive sort of facts about you. And there's so much to talk about, as Bill alluded to. We're going to talk about that, but let's talk a little bit.
By the way, first time we've had a New York Times bestseller on our podcast.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Fact?
Fact.
Boom.
Fact.
Boom.
Pretty crazy.
See, that's why this show just continues to
climb. So I met David.
I remember it.
When we were competing with each other in the search marketing space.
Okay.
Search engine marketing. This is like before Google went public, a bunch of kind of tech and optimization companies came out all around how to optimize Google search results. He founded a company called Clickable.
Mm-hmm.
I was running a company called Did It. And I was like, I don't know what his tech does, but this guy has the best fucking hair. And I and I pride myself on my hair.
Yeah, good.
But it was flowing.
Awkward, yes,
no,
yeah,
but
yeah.
His hair was flowing. It was long. It was good. And for years, I was like, fucking Kidder. Great head of hair. Great head of hair.
That is something special up there, actually.
I actually feel like I'm losing it. It's starting to like creep back. It's like it's inescapable truth.
No,
it's
but
like,
dude, you went short. It used to be flowy and long. Now it's short. So we're going to get into that as well.
So this is your backstory of knowing Kidder is Clickable and amazing here, which is about the time that we met as well.
Yeah.
David, where are you? where give us a little backdrop of where Little Kidder started his life.
Sure. So we're in your alma mater, just outside of Albany, New York. I grew up in Gilderland, and a family of four. Dad was a psychologist. My mom was a writer.
So writing is in the blood.
Yes. It was. Admire them for that. And then I studied in Rochester, New York, RIT. Mm-hmm. And then
you didn't go very far.
No,
Live at home when you did that?
No, Rochester's maybe 2-3 hours from Albany. So, but I played lacrosse and did industrial design and loved that school. It's like a frozen tundra, dork fest of
What's it known for? What's?
It's very interdisciplinary. It's like science and engineering.
Is this RPI?
Science, RIT.
RIT. RIT. Yeah. It's for people who don't get into MIT.
Exactly. Yeah, right. It is kind of, or CMU, which is my favorite school in the world. So it's like it's kind of like the junior varsity to those other programs. But there's not a chance I could get into the school now. I know that for a fact.
Yeah.
I have friends with kids who are on all the accelerated courses.
Sure.
And they're applying. I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
I'd be
By the way, I talk about this with my friends and colleagues all the time. I go, hey, none of us. Well, maybe me. I didn't go to a good school. So, although I love my school. But most people are like, I was like, you would never get in there today.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, yeah, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Yep. And the level of competition to get into schools is ridiculous now.
It's crazy.
So, ironically, I'm going to go back. I'm speaking at RIT in April, and they invite us back, and it's kind of fun. I met the president before, and so it's kind of fun to, have a relationship with the school where I was, dying to get in and stay in. And so it worked out okay, but and then after that, it's just the beginning.
What did you major in?
I studied industrial design, which was a kind of an interdisciplinary school between, design and engineering to make products. And so I.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so by my junior year, I had won this thing called the ID, this magazine called International Design Magazine, ID.
That's when magazines existed.
Yeah, that's what it did.
For those of you watching at home, magazines,
those things that you flip,
used to get them in the mail, yes. And they were kind of like websites, but in paper.
So they had this international award, and they did it professionally, and then they had chosen a couple of students around the world. And so I won this thing, and I'm working for Kodak in the summer because of this internship.
Kodak.
And literally, we were designing the first digital cameras, and it was so painful to work there. I was like, I can never work for anyone. And I had this wonderful boss named Don Harrell. He's a great guy, by the way. And it just was like I was in like a veal cubicle. It looked like this. Like it was
corporate,
like this wall.
Corporate.
And I was like, I got to get out of here. And it was the dawn of the internet. So it was like 95, 96.
What made you want to get into industrial design? I mean, what kind of sparked that?
I was very good at fine arts and decent enough at math that I probably couldn't get either degree. And this is one that I was very passionate about, making things. And I knew this later in my life, which was I love products. And so I just think some kids have teddy bears. I had a broomer, which my parents gave me, which was a blender. Baby, I slept with a blender. How weird is that, right?
What do you mean? I don't know.
Literally, cut the cord off, of course. But it was like my toy. It was like I had a toy blender.
You slept with like hardware glass?
Literally a blender. This is my toy. It was like, I don't know if I slept with it, but it was kind of weird. But I loved products and making things.
Wait, before you go, Bill.
Can you move through this one? This is weird.
David.
No, we're going to spend the entire podcast on
this. A lot of the times, this show is sort of pushes people's careers forward.
Okay, good.
It does incredible things for them, and I want to make sure that we do that for you as well.
I don't think I've ever revealed that. Actually, that's
weird. And Hannah, you okay? Okay.
Hold on. So I'm getting this picture of a young David who's kind of geeky, right? I mean,
yes.
he sleeps with a blender, but yet you played lacrosse, which is kind of cool.
I did. Yes.
So
I wrestled.
Were you cool, or were you a geek, or a nerd, or did you? Were you the bridge between those two groups?
It's a complex question because I didn't realize until a couple of years ago that as I sort of walked through the world when I was 6 to probably 16, one of the hugest impacts of my life is that I had, when I was 6, I had a very big bike accident, and I glasses smashed, and they cut through my face. So I had 100 stitches in my face, which you can see it now.
I never really noticed that.
And so I literally,
bicycle
with glasses, and they smashed. So I kind of walked through the world quite literally with a scar. And so I think I was very quiet and a little insecure. I knew I was about walking, being scarred as a little kid. And so I think I tried to like feel better. So I was like, I was a performer in sports and school. And I think by the time I got to 16, I was like, wait, I'm pretty good at a couple things, but not a lot of things.
So it's almost like you were pushing yourself to be on the stage or on a platform.
Well, I think everybody does when they have, whatever shame is in their life, they try to work through it. I think mine was, you know, to push hard in a couple places. Like
you strike me as somebody.
By the way, ever since you, now I can't stop staring at the scar.
I know.
And by the way, I never noticed it before.
I know. I can't. I'm gonna hit this.
Just hit it again. You've all struck me. If I had to bet, is that you knew like being a nerd was great and cool before most people recognized being a nerd was great.
Yeah. So I definitely had like a nerd quality, but kind of interdisciplinary nerd, like. School, sports, and art, and things like that. And
okay, your first job out of school?
My first job was at like 11, 12, like in frozen tundra, you know, paper route, you know, week, 5 a.m.
I want my $2.
I didn't cover a lot of money, so I had to hustle, and that was it. So that turned into like working at Mike DeRossi Sports at Albany. You probably remember that for years.
Yeah, I remember that.
What time do you start doing the paper route? Like, what time do you, like, go there? It's, like, 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
Like, you got a route and you...
On a BMX bike in the winter. It was, like, it was ridiculous. But I learned me... I just get up very early as a...
Can you show us, like, how you... Like, can you show us how you tossed it? Was it like that? Was it...
Well, the bag, when you're little, it's, like, this huge Times Union bag. And you just, like, tip over and your back crunches. But I did.
All right,
let's
get past the paper routes. Yeah, what was the first job after RIT?
So I actually started working in RIT in my freshman year for a startup called the Idea Group for like industrial design, engineering, something associates. And it was founded by a guy named Bill Gillette, who really took me under his wing and was very good to me. And I learned my first startup. I was like a 5 and a 10 person company, and we worked with Pro Engineer and Wavefront Alias to do industrial design engineering for Bausch & Lomb and Xerox and Kodak. And so I just grew up working almost part-time during school, 20 hours a week, and full-time to the summers for all those years. And what came through that, because we worked with Silicon Graphics boxes, was this thing called WebForce, which came out in 96, which was the first web server to compete with like Netscape servers.
Wow.
And so the resellers were like, we need authoring software. Could you provide services? And so we... Age 20, built like our first kind of tool agency, and we powered all the web development tools and services for Y&R in Rochester.
Wow.
And we built that company up, and then we sold it like 2 years later. So I was working in a startup and then created one, and then by the time I was 21, 22, we ended up exiting, made a little bit of money, and then came to New York and helped do
early kind of 2000s?
No, this was 96 to
98. Okay.
So very early. And then we did a company that I joined. It was backed by Omnicom, Bruce Reddick, Felice Kincannon.
Yeah.
Was Razorfish, agency.com, Think New Ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
They had taken that public, and then they merged it. And then I started on a company called SmartRay when I was like 27.
What'd that do?
So also in the marketing spaces, but we built like raised $5 million in venture, a 30-person engineering team that was building on top of TIBCO. Remember TIBCO, the bus? It was
By the way, Vista owns TIBCO.
They do. Oh. I know that for a fact.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. And so for a long time, for like 10 years.
No, it's a massive company.
It's a massive company. In fact, it was the first like true $20-plus billion internet company back when.
Yeah.
And so they could take this like atomic level of data, like, you know, from Instanet and Reuters and NASDAQ and organize it. But what they couldn't do is like tell you when it changed. So we built an alerting technology, data feed handlers that could tell you like what's happening. So only notify me when it's below 50 degrees and rainy on a Wednesday. And there's a huge difference between like, hey, my flight's canceled, my flight's delayed, which is like you buy a cup of coffee, versus my flight's canceled, which is it's a $1,000 purchase decision. So we built a system through WAP devices that alerted you on mobile back when Sprint came out with that. Remember that fun handset with the big screen?
Yeah.
And so we ended up selling that company to, two deals, one that blew up for about $78 million to a company I can't mention, but the CEO is still a good friend. And then we sold for like a little under 40 or 45 to another company down in Virginia. And then we moved down there. So that was my kind of first real exit.
At the ripe age of?
28.
28.
Any interest in learning?
By the way, you said you moved to Virginia?
Well, yes. I moved down to Reston for like 30 seconds. So I integrated. Okay. And then 90 days later.
Out.
Yeah, well, the CEO and I had competing visions. And I asked him in the meeting, also still a good friend, but I said, what would you do if you were me? And he's like, I would fire me. I'm like, you're right. I'm like, yes. And so I bought 2 years of my life and took my little winnings, and I traveled to 40 countries and came home. And
no way.
It was awesome. I started Tibet.
When did you meet your wife?
So I met her when I got back. I was like okay. 2 years later.
So you're 28.
Mm-hmm.
You made a little bit of coin. You got the guy to agree to fire you,
which is brilliant.
Which is a solid move.
Yes.
And then you traveled to 40 countries. What was your favorite country?
And best
Africa.
Experience. Yeah.
I mean, Africa is so like you think about Big Sky, but when you are traveling, when you do the entire Serengeti migration in like a truck with a driver and you're alone for a couple weeks in the world with no mobile phone.
Yeah.
You're like, you're tiny. Yeah.
I mean, it was a time we're driving across the plains and we got like caught in a tiny ditch. Like just the car, sitting there and you're like, we're dead.
Yeah.
And you jack yourself up and you be careful. You're not going to get stalked by a bunch of lions, and you keep going and you travel over hills and valleys.
So you said we. Who's we?
I was with a driver for those time too.
You didn't go with like friends or
no.
Amazing. We had a guest. I don't remember.
So you traveled for 2 years.
Well, on and off. So there's a big bucket of time, and then in and out. So after about 10, 12 weeks, 14 weeks, you start. It's disorienting. So I'd go to London, then fly back, and go back to the States. So it was that period of time. Yeah.
It almost sounds like it was so long, it almost sounds like you were running from something or hiding from something. Like, that's a long, a couple of months, I get, or a year. That's a long time.
No, it wasn't that. I think I was just decompressing.
What was the place that you, what country or city did you visit that maybe you'd like to have back that just wasn't that fulfilling? Or just didn't meet your expectations is probably a better way to frame it.
I don't know. I don't know how that's a lens I would look that through. I think there's some places that it would be good for me to spend more time in because
get
of
to know better.
The mercy that's required to be there. Like, I mean, when you go to like, Laos and you go to like the Tonle Sap Great Lake and you see this 80,000 hectare lake, which has dry seasons shrink and expand, and you like literally are out there with no one and you meet the people who live in the lake, and 30 years later, the communists in the area attack people in the lake ritualistically.
Yeah.
So they float in the middle and they fight them off. And it's a rolling tragedy for decades. And we realize like all the things are that. So there's places that you just want to go back out and
try it again,
experience and feel it.
So is there something, that you kind of took away from your travels? Cause like there's so few people who get to do that at the age you were. Do you like often find yourself going, was a light bulb go off for you during that trip or something where like you learned something just stayed with you?
Well, one is the world's really small.
Yeah.
And it's also really connected. Yeah. I mean, you don't realize, I don't think you think about like the butterfly effect, but you start realizing the knock-on effect of policy and, our own politics, our own, geopolitical balances in the world. They're never little things. Like even statements and positions to take have generational effects that we're feeling now and we have in the past, but even in a greater sort of wake than we ever have at this moment. So that's one. Two is, and then my wife has driven this, which is the idea of experience over things. So I'm kind of a things performing guy, and she's very much a experience thing. I think the boys have leaned heavily towards experience. So we did, a couple months of the road this year. They've been to a couple dozen countries. So that is really important and has been important to us because, they're going to leave. I have a 14-year-old. You guys have younger and older kids. And that's the glue, like those grooves in their mind.
That you remember. That,
yeah.
Yep.
So you or your wife come into a little bit of money, a little bit of coin.
I'm still grindy, but yes.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
But so instead of buying, an electric car, you're going to take everyone to a trip.
Or both. I don't know. Like, funny, yes. I haven't figured all that out.
Okay.
Guess, so.
All right. Yes. So did you also...
It's an and, not an or yet. I think I'm the and of the
so,
or.
So it's funny because in my mind, you have always been an entrepreneur.
Yeah,
like 100%. In my mind, I was looking forward to being like, oh no, I had a desk job here and I did this and I did that. But like basically what you're saying is you became an entrepreneur in college.
Yep.
You experienced a little bit of success that you didn't really participate in. Then you went to a couple other startups. Started another one, had some success, got some coin, then traveled, right? That's such an entrepreneur thing to do.
Yeah.
And so you've never actually worked.
hard.
Like, you know,
for anybody,
for
yes,
anybody.
But,
yeah.
But like you, I've, you know, it's a funny story. It's like, it's a classic overnight success. It's like,
yeah,
I'm 47. I'm still grinding.
Yeah.
I've had modest success. And I mean that, really modest, but I love the conviction in the things I do. So it matters, but doesn't matter what the outcome is. There's really, I guess philosophically is that I just don't think there's any, there's no sort of like top of the mountains that is interesting to me, because you get there, you realize there's nothing there.
Well, you also realize that you realize that you can't work for somebody else, and also you have the capability and skill set to build on your own. You're, you've been a builder.
Yeah.
So you come back from this trip.
Yep.
What do you do?
Of course,
you met your wife. That's a big one.
That's a huge thing. And then
You meet her? Did you meet her on this journey?
Unrelated, two different couples, unrelated in a period of like 3 days. So it was one of those things where you pay attention. And like anything, I'm all in. And so go fast, right? So, you know, if I'm like this last year, I ran this crazy marathon with 100 days of training, having not worked out in 25 years. Like, again, go.
Yeah.
You know? So that's our life. It's like really kind of crazy. It's like, you know, get married super fast, have a first kid, first house, first dog, second kid, second house. It's just like, it's kind of nutty. But that's how we roll in this chapter.
Yeah.
And then along the way, I invested in a bunch of companies. I've made about 40 angel investments over the last 15 years. Started a company that didn't work, and then Clickable.
What was that company?
I put money behind a company that was doing like last mile fiber infrastructure. I don't know why,
but
I loved the founder's a good friend, and I loved it. And I actually got to work with one of my best friends who died of cancer last year.
Sorry to hear that.
Which I'm very privileged and grateful for.
It
happened.
That time.
Yeah, and I did that, and then started Clickable, which was like, let's get the band back together, and raised a crap load of money super fast. Like, you know, we raised $22 million and like a year and a couple months, and then, you know, the Series C was like 4 years later. So it was like one of those crazy
things. So for our audience, tell us what the origin of Clickable was and why Clickable at the time.
So the origin of Clickable was, you know, prior to like machine learning and AI, and I'm really not trying to like commingle like hot topics with what we were doing, but and in fact, what we filed and received our patent on was something called the ACT Engine, which is this idea that, you know, every day someone in search or social wakes up and asks the question, like, how am I doing and what I need to improve? And that's a very complex question because, as you guys know, because you actually helped design this with David Fisher, was one of the most complex API architectures in the world, which was basically an efficient frontier to you know, spend all your money to keep up with the API compliance and then die on the other side of it after we give you all your money. So you're familiar with that, right?
Yeah.
Thank you for that, by the way.
You're welcome. That was a freebie.
Thanks. Great lesson. And that lesson was, don't ever build your company on someone else's monopoly, which was a, looking back, it's clear. But so Clickable built that engine. And so the challenge for us was, where's the rich and paying customer? So you built that system to arm you with all the tools to know exactly what to do in the morning and what to do to improve. And the question was, which is the more valuable customer? Mm-hmm. Was it the enterprise or was it the SMB? So lots of little guys and girls who could like use this tool, but in a way, we were too expensive for those small people and didn't have enough features for the big ones. So we're stuck in the middle, which is about the worst place you could be for SaaS. So it took us like 3 years to figure that out. So we ballooned the company and got to like, you know, sub $10 million revenue and kind of striking distance, you know, within 6-12 months of what we could, if we pulled back, be profitable. And we did a huge partnership with Amex. And this is public knowledge.
I remember that.
Yep. Yeah. And so we, you know, they took our platform to the masses. They made a ton of money on Google on their cards.
Yep.
And they needed tools. And so they spent a huge bet to, like, build out marketing suites.
And that was a partnership, though. That was, like, a commercial-oriented deal.
Oh, yeah.
That was not a strategic investment or –
It became one because it obviously was strategic, which was, if this works, we'll buy you. That was – Allen & Company as our banker and the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
We're backed by the Founders Fund and USV and others, which, thank God, I'm still good friends with all them.
Right.
Thank you, Rick and Albert and Fred and Peter and everybody. But we had, like, basically building two companies at once.
Yeah.
So we had a beautiful, amazing culture, but it was like a Siamese twin-headed kid. Like, there's only one parent in the world who loves that kid. It's you, right? And so, like, you're super weird to everybody else. And so at some point, grinding.
By the way, we were, like, kind of competing with them, and we were like – What are they doing?
Yeah.
Like, how? Like, you
did
know,
anyone ever come to you and maybe offer like a different name of the company than Clickable, or was it that was
that's
that,
a great name? What are you talking
was
about?
Was that no? Was that the best name at the time? It was.
It
right?
was the great name from day one. It was actually part of the best. It's still around. David Fault bought it. He owns it.
Kidder,
he
what,
bought the name?
He owns it through his company, Brand Networks.
Brand Networks.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, are you so gonna he was my COO for years.
No, I know that.
Yeah, I love Dave. He's awesome.
So do I.
Hi, Dave. Love you, buddy.
Hi, Dave. So, hold on. But you sold Clickable to...
We ended up ripping it in two. We took the Simon metaphor, but we took the split in half.
Yeah.
Back to Amex, and then we merged it with another company called SynCap. So it was purely
SynCap. SynCap.
Yep.
And then I was like out in like a month.
Did you know about the SynCap side of the twin, or do you know about the Amex?
I knew both.
Michael Fisher, the CEO, who's a great guy, and they ended up taking the whole company, less our sales team, forward. And then, you know, a year and a half, the whole social world. After Buddy Media got acquired, it was like, it was like explosion.
Buddy Media got acquired by Salesforce.com.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, it, yeah. The
and then there were two.
Exploded.
There's Wildfire, and there was the one out of Atlanta.
There's another one. That was like the moment. That was like the tipping point. And I admire, Mike and those guys did a phenomenal job of getting those companies across the finish line with focus. You know, Michael really focused really well on delivering a value that was valuable to the world. And we had lost ours. We had built two focuses, which is, you know, sacrosanct.
So what would you have done differently if you can go back and redo Clickable?
I would have stayed, completely focused on the ACT engine.
Right.
I would have done one thing. And what this inspired.
Meaning you would have just focused on
the thing
software.
We began with. Yeah, 100%.
Software and AI.
Machine learning, but yes, eventually there was enough compute to figure this stuff out. But the beginning of the end of breaking that company up, what began in a single final session at Andreessen Horowitz. I wrote about it in my book. So USV introduced us to Andreessen Horowitz. And I'm sitting in the finals. They had done some diligence and they were interested in the company. And I'm sitting
Come
with
closer.
Mark and Ben.
Yep.
My CFO at the time, Bart Hacking, is a wonderful guy. And so they sit back and they're like, listen, we love the brand, love the idea, you know, the stuff. And they said, but Willie, I have one question. And this is from Mark. And he says, he's like, David, he goes, what happened when this partnership fails?
You mean the Amex?
Yeah. And I looked at him. I swear to God, I just started laughing. I was like, Mark, I literally haven't even thought about that. And he and Ben look at each other and start dying laughing. They're just like, you're going to have the worst fucking 2 years of your life, Kidder. Like, we tried this at LoudCloud. Like, it's going to be a disaster. And so it was kind of like, and I walked out and I thought to myself, first of all, I love the candor. Like, Ben Horowitz is my, he's the Andy Grove of our generation.
Right.
I love him. He wrote great plug for our last book. I admire him so much. Those two books, his last.
I had one conversation with Ben in my lifetime. And it was when I was raising money. I was raising money for Media Bank before it became Media Ocean. And he was like, hey, listen, I like the business. He goes, but for this type of profile, I'm going to need participating preferred. Here's the interest rate. I'm going to need a preference on top of that. And he's like, and I just want to tell you up front because I don't want to waste your time.
Right.
And I was like, well, that's not going to work for me. And he goes, well, anything other than this isn't going to work for me. And I go, God, this was like the most efficient meeting. I mean, I would have wasted 20 hours and five meetings to get to this point.
Yeah.
And he just was like, I felt like I was like in the middle of a checker game and he was like, checkmate. And I go, we're playing checkers. He's like, not anymore. No, we're not. Yeah. We're playing chess.
That's helpful.
I think that's his version of a polite no. It's like, if you don't have enough conviction to defend your business on like ratcheted dilution, like you don't believe in it. So it's like it's a ninja move, but like having been on the other side of the table, what that inspired me to do is like I was like, I need to grow by two decades of experience right now. And the gift in this was while I was on the road like a maniac, I just started interviews with like my friends and their friends of friends, Reid Hoffman, Elon, Sarah Blakely, these incredible entrepreneurs, and I basically asked them two questions, which is how do you bet your life? Mm-hmm. And what do you do in the first 5 years not to die? Because I was like, how do I not know this? I was 30-something, grinding, and I'm in the room by the best VCs in the world, and I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And so that became the startup playbook. So in a way, like everything
– The
universe is there for you. It's there to teach
So in the midst of all this, right, because you do a startup, you're doing the ACT engine, you then were like, oh, I got a fork in the road. I decided – most people have – when they reach a fork – say, I got to choose one. You were like, nope, I'm just going to split the car in two and go down both avenues of the fork. But in the midst of all this, you wrote a New York Times bestseller.
Yes.
What's the name of that book?
So that was actually before we wrote two, actually, of the five books at the same time, which is quite extraordinary. So my creative side, because I don't golf, because no scratch golfer has ever named five of the year, they say. So I suck at it, too. And I, by ninth hole, I want to shoot myself. So I wrote it's this book series game. Called, around the time I started Clickable, called The Intellectual Devotional. And it's a
love this book.
It's a great book. And it's 5 minute a day readings. Every day is like, you know, science, math, religion, philosophy, literature, et cetera. So throughout a year, 365 days, you can renew your mind. Mm-hmm. And I spent a year co-authoring that with the president of NBC, Noah Oppenheim, and I illustrated it. So I designed, illustrated, and helped create this book. So I just did figure black and white drawings.
So I characterized the intellectual devotional as, like, if you just want to, like, be interesting at a cocktail party, just read this book for like 10 minutes before you go.
Right.
Yeah.
And you like, you know, tackling. You get it.
And it's, you could read it if you, I don't know, a lot of people do devotionals for the kids or spiritual ones.
Yeah.
It's a great intellectual companion for the kids. So it turns out we launched that in the Today Show, number one everywhere around the world. And
incredible.
And then the second one did the same thing.
Story.
So that book, true, as we sit here, is the number one book in Japan 10 years later.
To this day.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It's incredible.
No explanation of how or why.
I just think it hits a nerve. Right. Like, it's like analog and learning, and it
but
it matters. Is it
also maybe the insights that were driven based on these extraordinary people that you?
Well, that was the second. That was the second. No, alongside this.
Then you know the reason why? This book is perfect to leave next to every single toilet in the world.
Okay, so funny you mentioned this. When it came out, I have friends who are in real estate that always be like, your book has the highest urea level in the world because people leave in the bathroom. So, true story. So, I was at TED. This is now, because TED sent out is a TED book like in 2007, 2008. Mm-hmm. So, I go to dinner with a friend of mine, Keith Ferrazzi, with like 15 people at the TED conference. This is when it was back in Monterey, the early days.
Yeah.
So, at table, and at the table. Hi,
do you present at TED?
No. I did a couple years later, but in the side forum. But in the, so I've been part of that community now for about 12, 13, 14 years. So I'm at dinner, and I'm sitting at the table with Keith Ferrazzi, he wrote a bunch of books, Never Eat Alone. He's a wonderful guy. And so across me is a bunch of, it's very LA, super celebrity. It's like Goldie Hawn and, you know, Meg Ryan. I have no idea who these people are.
Right.
And of course, by the end of the night, because I'm like the least interesting person at the table, literally, Goldie Hawn's like, so what do you do? And why are you here? And I was like, well, I'm like, you know, little guy. I was like, well, my book, this Intellectual Devotion, was set up by TED. She goes, oh, my God. She goes, did you know that Steven Spielberg sends that book out every year as his holiday gift?
Stop it.
And I looked at her. I was like, how would I know that? Like,
Steven shot me a note yet.
Like 2,000 of them, apparently, for years. And I finally met him a couple years ago, and I was like, I'm the goofball who created that book series. So those are, it's just one of those crazy karmic things. What it taught me is your ideas matter.
Mm-hmm.
When I chased white space or like was my urgency was high, I actually have not been that successful.
Mm-hmm.
I was like chasing the opportunity. I didn't have obsession. I didn't really care more than anybody else in the world.
But I'm interested in how you came up with the idea to write the book, how you met your partner in the book. Like, how did that come about?
So Noah was my intern at SmartRite for years when he was like a junior, senior at Harvard. And then he went on to become very successful. And so when I created the book, like, it was sort of kind of his beautiful mind type of content. And it was like a startup to me. It was like, how do you get the best team at the table? And he was one of them. And we just, it ended up just hitting a nerve and doing very, very well.
Unbelievable.
The Startup Playbook was really a journey to figure out how to bet your life.
So, by the way, Startup Playbook is his third book.
Sixth book. That book was.
Who can keep up, you know?
I mean that in a way because it's relevant because of the timeline. But
oh, the Intellectual Devotional has, it was one book, then it was a second book.
Yeah, modern. So there was the general one, which is my favorite one. There was American History, Health, Pop culture, biography, and does it health or modern culture?
Yeah, you're up to five.
That's it. Sorry.
So you got five. Oh, so you did that whole series. That's five.
And then,
but now I'm curious. Having written a book that nobody wants to publish,
we should publish it.
There's very little money in books unless you're successful.
Then
so,
there's a lot of money. You could do fairly well with
it. So did you make any money on the first one? Because that's the most successful one.
Yes. So let's just say somewhere between like $249,000 and $251,000. Like, that was our super right. excited. And then it was just like.
And then, but then from there, now that it's a New York Times bestseller, they're like, we want more of this.
Yeah, it's a momentum play.
And it's a momentum play.
Like one more, and then it was like a, so it was much more, and it was like a series.
Yeah.
And then if you clear out your back end royalty, then you just.
But imagine.
Because like, now that's your sixth book, which is the startup playbook. I feel like my book is like. It takes that book up one notch.
I bet it does.
So you made money on that book too?
I think we are probably now. But I think the last two have not – the intention wasn't really – it was kind of sharing the learning. I wanted a beautiful book, but it wasn't really about
– Yeah.
I don't – honestly, I don't think I have the intellectual confidence to, like, write a good business book. My mindset was just – I feel like I should just share this learning. If I can make a quality product, it's not about me.
Right.
I only wrote one original part of it, which was the introduction, which ironically is because.
Yeah, so this is just successful entrepreneurs and businessmen.
I needed to learn it.
And business
for yourself.
How
you
about your
to
life?
Share.
And the answer.
But imagine the residual effect of those books as relates to your, we're going to get into Bionic and what you do now with your brands. There's, who knows how to quantify the real value or how much money that his firm has earned or David's brand has earned, right? Outside of
I don't even think of it that way, but
I know, but still, who knows? But I know you're not trying to count pennies off of these endeavors, right? You're trying to give back.
And by the way, when Goldie Hawn was like, "Oh, what about you, Mr. Little David?" What she was really like was like, "Oh my God, that flowing head of hair! This guy's gotta be
he looks
someone
smart.
Important."
If you have were your glasses always that rad as well?
I've always had these glasses are my thing because I've always worn glasses. I have like super bad astigmatism, like footballs. Like if I don't.
What?
Like,
and then just one more question in regards to the adventure of writing a book. Are there any like sort of I guess basic principles in regards to where you start, how you start, or the commitment to what goes into, you know, for maybe someone that has thought about it and doesn't even know what the right step is? I mean, how do you've done this so many times now? There must be some level of formula or commitment or time, or is there a cabin in Maine? Like what, you know?
No, I think listen, I for both of. The last two, it's been around like urgency. Like I feel it's obsession. Honestly, I think you should really value your obsessions. I think and your ideas. There are marketplaces that exist and they're often cemented. But I think honestly, if I look back and the lesson of all this is, your unfair advantage is you. It's not the marketplace. It's the power of your obsession with solving or learning something and then sharing it.
Yeah.
And so I think I really learned that. Like if I look back at Index, like. The things I chased, I failed at. The things I have cared most deeply about, forget the money.
Mm-hmm.
I've had asymmetrical successful outcomes because literally I care more than most of the world and no one can outwork me when I care more about that one thing.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I think that's
the
thing.
By the way, I
so it's narrow and focused.
When I meet with younger people, I always say your goal in life is to find your passion, right? Don't chase it because you want – like. If you find your passion, and I don't care what that passion is, you know, kind of like six, you know, kind of like wealth will follow you.
Yeah.
And that wealth may not be monetary wealth. It may be, you know, come in different forms. But like, you know, and I think that's what's different between like maybe our generation and certainly the ones below us, which is like when I went to college, I picked accounting as my major because we just finished the recession of the late 80s. And the only people getting jobs were accountants and teachers.
Yeah.
And I was like, so I got to make money. I'm paying for college. I got to make money.
Here.
And so a lot, like, I think it started ending with our generation, but certainly the next generation, they don't worry about, like, they don't worry about being hugely successful, got to go into banking, got to make money. It's like they truly are following their passion.
But in addition, something that I heard or learned about you, David, is I think there's, in particular this generation, you've actually wanted to give back. I mean, a lot of the success has been tied to your interest of sharing these insights and learnings for other people to discover on their own, which I don't really know is the general sort of behavior of most people. They're maybe more sort of self-included, where they just want to take those learnings and not give them out. But it seems like to write a good book, you really want to, like, you have an obsession, but you want other people to benefit as a result.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you ask my team at Bionic or most people in my life, that they'd probably say I'm pretty radically vulnerable, and so I share a lot of stuff. So the books were literally the naked truth. Like, I don't know this stuff. and I need to know this, and so do you. And so that was the sharing of it. And it forced me. I'm like the dog that caught the car. Like, I'll do something unless I, like, just, like, get the book contract.
Right.
And I'm forced to do it. Yeah. Forced to run the marathon. So that was the key. And so summarizing that book, these five lenses, is basically these five criteria that, if you're going to bet your life, have to be true in the first 3 years, which is how long it takes to figure out the business, right?
Right,
yeah.
The Gladwellian 10,000 hours. And that became central to not only my investment philosophy, but Bionic in that learning. And that's where that grit came. But,
well, I remember your marathon story, if I remember a post, which was like you committed to a – it almost sounds like when you make a level of commitment, whether you reach for it or they discover you and say, hey, here's your offer, you fulfill on it. With your marathon story, it was somewhat – you basically committed to
a – for the boys, yeah.
You did it for your boys, right?
And I also lost one of my best friends to cancer who had made it to the top, incredibly successful.
So what do you mean you did it for your boys? So I know you have three sons.
Three sons, 9, 12, and 14. Well, one is that it hurt a lot. Like, to do it, because I didn't work out for 25 years.
So you decided to honor your friend who passed away, but and your sons. You just announced that you were running a marathon?
I didn't. I surprised them in mile 8. So I decided with a heart.
What?
Yeah.
He does everything right, Bill.
So, jeez. Yeah, we say all the time, we started this because we're like two semi-successful guys, and all this podcast ever does is make me feel I am underachieving.
I know. Not at all. I admire both of you guys. Don't say.
So you train without your kids knowing.
Up at 5, I started with 104 days before the marathon.
Okay.
Bought an app, bought a ticket from charity, and I'd gone through some very significant deep work that I significant revelations around how I got to where I was now and how I wanted to live my life going forward.
Yep.
Of which one of those convictions was to really make choices in abundance as opposed to fear. And that huge shift in my mind has energized my whole life. But that was one of the things. And having lost David, who I love, and watching him pass 12 hours before he passed away, and say things that were really difficult to hear, like, what was it all worth? Those things.
Yeah.
Made reflect and say, one is, this stuff is, it's just physical. You know, we're kind of roving around the world in our consciousness and our meat suit getting pounded on. Yeah. But above that and with us, our observer self is with us always. And it's saying to us is like, I love you, Chris. I love you, Bill. I love you, David. And in that context, there's power and safety. And I want what's good for you. And so because of that, you can make choices that are good for you. Mm-hmm. You're no longer a zombie controlled by your whatever was coded in your subconscious. You actually can choose those things. And so in that moment, making that decision to run this was really a proof point, which is my conscious self is so much more powerful than my physical self. Mm-hmm. And so that was like a crazy bet because I have a heart condition. I could have like bit the dust, no joke. And so I started training, got up at 5, and within 2 weeks I'm running 5 miles, 3 minutes, 8.
God,
and so I did two
it.
Long runs, right? At like the last 3 weeks, I did a 20, 18 mile, and 15 miles. So I woke up from, you know where I live, right?
Yeah.
I woke up at 5 in the morning, and I went and ran straight from my house to the Bronx.
Huh? So
and back. And at 11 o'clock, my kids are like,
where were you? Well, that was my next question, which was
5 hours.
Yeah.
Hold on.
So they
totally ignored me.
This is unbelievable. I never heard this stuff.
Okay, so they – I did the training, didn't tell anybody.
How many days a week were you running during
four.
That? Four out of 7 days, so every other day.
Yep, and then the end story is that my au pair went to watch their au pair, our old pair, run the race.
Yep.
And we watched her go by, Laura, we left her, and then about 30 minutes later, I showed up. And in mile 8, my boys were like, what? And big hugs, chokes me up, love them up, and I was just like –
yeah,
you have no excuses in your life.
Yeah,
like there's nothing you can't do.
Yeah.
Without the power of your conviction.
Yeah,
and to me, it brought me basically to the leave my home.
Yeah,
no excuses.
Wow,
and it hurt, but it was worth it.
So how long did you? How long? Like what did you do?
It took
me 4.5 hours.
Five hours.
Yeah. So.
But I did run. I literally ran the whole thing, which I wanted to do was
you just want to cross.
So
the
you, line, you so. Didn't you didn't like you might have gone to a slow jog, but
I did not stop.
Didn't,
I mean, there's water stations.
Yeah.
And you take a break.
So,
by the way, you also mentioned you didn't work out for 25 years.
Literally, I'm back to where I was before. Just spike it.
By the way, it's a huge.
Holy
so I've done
crap.
I've done six.
And you can do it, by the way.
Yeah, no, I don't know if I can.
No, Bill, you could.
You just make the decision, and you can do it. I'm serious.
So, David, I've done six in the last four.
Yeah.
I was always probably too busy, like, partying and getting after it, where I didn't do the proper training, and always at mile, you know, whatever,
19, 20.
It was always here, and I'd have to go deep in here to be like, okay, you know, my father passed, so I think about him. And, like, literally those last two or three miles – in tears, tired.
Yeah, totally.
The only reason I got through that is just all mental. Like, the body will actually do things that you're not aware it will do.
Yeah.
But my own experience doing that, it's amazing. That's why the marathon is such an incredible gift for those that do it, is because it's the very few times that you can actually sort of understand the power of your body and your mind.
It's profound.
Outside of that, you don't really have a chance to know what you're capable of doing.
Yeah,
so,
incredible.
Let's get into let's get into Bionic.
All right, so hold on. I need to know. So you know, so I knew David, the flowing hair, the clickable, all this other stuff,
and the longest podcast of superpowers.
Yeah, it's okay. It's all worth it.
I know.
We're getting out of time, but we're good.
It's all worth it. It's all worth it.
Just tear all the humble brag.
No, it's all worth it.
We don't cut. We don't edit.
Oh,
so here's the deal. I knew Kidder. You know, I was always impressed with him. And then we ran into each other locally up in Westchester, and he starts telling me about Bionic, right? And I'm like, all right, this guy, you know, I've gotten to know him.
Yeah.
We shared some rides. So he starts all excited about starting Bionic. I walked away and I go, I have no fucking clue what this guy is doing. Like, and then so I meet him a second time.
Have you heard this yet?
I meet him a second time months and months later, and I go, hey, you still doing that like thing? And he goes, yeah, but let me tell you what we're doing now. And he tells me, I walk away, I go, I have no idea what he's doing. I literally have no idea what he's doing.
So what I'd
like for you to do is tell the audience what Bionic is.
Yes.
And then I want Chris to decipher what that is.
Okay, and before you do, just do it differently than you did the first two times, okay?
By the way, this is like probably, you know, 6 years ago.
So we just finished our seventh year
January. So 6 or 7 years
ago. So, Bill, the thing's working.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not perfect. I mean, every startup goes through its grind, but it's been a gift.
All right, what's the elevator pitch? What is Bionic to?
So Bionic is a service company, bootstrap service company that helps large enterprises grow. And we do that by installing something we call a growth operating system. And it's the idea that venture capital and entrepreneurship are forms of management. So we come with the system, the methods and tools and mechanics, and the coaching to install this at the CEO level in some of the largest companies in the world. In a way, to think about it, it's like the anti-Six Sigma of this generation.
Stop right there. What does he do?
So I'm going to drop a couple words.
I get excited about it.
I know.
I conviction confuses the whole thing.
Is much tighter than it was 7 years ago.
I have to thank Christina Wallace, who's my co-author of this last book, because she's so disciplined in her thinking. She helped me.
Companies can't do this, and we're going to come in.
By the way, at that stage, he had like six different pitches in his his office in Rhinebeck. And so I've always understood Bionic as basically working with Fortune 100 brand leadership, CEOs, corporate level, and basically helping them understand how to think about today's technology and tools. So basically helping a Nike, helping a IBM or an Anheuser-Busch, P&G. Yes, we touted all the brands here. We need sponsorship dollars, Bill, ASAP. But basically, supporting whatever that engine is, which I can't explain. But the Bionic engine is getting those CEOs to think about.
It's the people operating engine. No, I'm joking.
How'd I do?
You guys are making me like
Kidder. Okay, Kidder, how'd I do? 7.2.
So by the way, it took me 7 years. So here's my interpretation.
Thought I did okay. You just blew off my thing.
Would you give him a 7.2?
I didn't actually score. I was just listening. So,
oh, yeah. What'd you give him? Like a 6? 6 out of 10?
7's great.
You'll give him a 7.
I'll give myself a 7.
All right. So it took me 7 years to figure this out. But what I now think is that Fortune 100 companies, for the first time, their scale is a disadvantage.
Yes.
Right? And that transformation is happening, and you see all these like direct-to-consumer brands, D2C brands, who aren't laced with this legacy business and legacy thinking and legacy processing. And they're able to come in and quickly get, you know, quick market share. Not huge, but, you know, you can get to 4, 5, 7% market share pretty quickly at the expense of these Fortune 100 brands. And what you are is that level of thinking within their organization, because they almost don't have the they don't have the DNA to do it themselves. Yeah. How is that?
It's pretty good. I like
is that like an 8, it's 9?
Good. I'd say, yeah, Steph, we'll go with 9 because we're not in the business every single day. But I would just say it's a systematic way of working that puts a large company on offense.
The fact that he threw something on top of yours meant that he wasn't satisfied.
Anyway, listen. It's,
by the way, the CEOs that are paying him don't even know. They just know he's written 5, going on 10 books. He's got sick hair.
Yeah.
He's a great father. And he's run marathons. And even internally, they're probably paying him like 6 figures a month. They're like, I have no idea what this is.
No, that's that's
transformation. It's all about business transformation.
We work with, we've been involved for years at the C-suite of some of these companies. So if they didn't understand,
I know, David, I know.
They are changing genetically. They're able now to do that 0 to $100 million skill they couldn't do before because they know portfolio theory. They know the total addressable problems in the world they're chasing. They know they're not launching 5 big bets they bought from McKinsey. They're the anti-McKinsey. They're going after buying, you know, launching 50 things into a category with a 90% failure rate because they know through a venture's mindset how to actually write a check, the difference between a seed versus a C round. So that skill of investing and thinking has changed the way they think about growth and where that model and the team that helped them do it.
And then we'll move on. But so McKinsey, like old school consulting companies, or I wouldn't say old school.
We could never be them. They could never be us.
Right.
We're the opposite of them.
That's all.
We never run into them.
Do you pitch against them? I was going to say, you don't pitch against them?
No.
This is actually one of the challenges of the business is that, I mean, I like to say, because I'm pathologically optimistic, that Bionic is truly a one-of-one company in the world.
It's a what?
A one-of-one company in the world. It's not chasing existing marketplace. It's creating a marketplace and then dominating it in a way that's like, which, by the way, is stupidly hard because I'm not going into an existing budget. I'm creating the budget with a CEO.
Right, yeah. which is tough when there aren't other comps and people don't know where to pull that from.
Exactly.
And you haven't seen a fish that swims like you before. Yes. So that probably makes it challenging from a new business perspective.
And that's like creating an industry despite, you know, listen, it's not technology.
So it's so funny because I have a bunch of friends in the industry that are trying to create categories, and they keep telling me how expensive it is to create a category. But what you're trying to do is create a category of one.
100%.
I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. That's like an upward hill battle.
It is. I mean, we're bootstrapped. We're in the, you know, we're over $20 million revenue with 55 people, and we're growing. So like, but it's hard. But and we have no backers. So this is
that bootstrap. Is that a bootstrap business?
Yep.
Okay.
7 years. You know, all organic.
Yep.
Over $20 million revenue. Is there a sense of a recurring nature to your business, or is it like do you have to continually sell?
Yes. And listen, I think
it was actually an either or, not a yes,
which is okay, by the way.
No, listen, here's the thing I'm learning about the business. So is that when you're dealing with CEOs of big companies, and the budget is discretionary of theirs, there's always outside forces. So like in a given year, like one of our partners, like TDA, will get acquired by Schwab, or we were at the end zone with one of the biggest technology companies in the world, and the CEO got fired. On the one hand, we're playing in a very elite category at the C-suite with 30 or 40 conversations at one time. But it's also the risk of the business, which is we have to get to scale. That means that we need to go from 12 customers to 20 or 30 in the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
We need half of our revenue secured every year. And we're just not there yet. We have 2 people on BD. Like it's small, like myself and
Well, how do you navigate to the 100 most powerful people in the business world?
It's a very small world. They all know each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if they have a secret and you can create an ecosystem around it, they will take you in. And so, listen, I had 6 weeks ago, I had the CEO of the year of a $1 trillion company at Bionic. So why would that guy come to Bionic?
Yeah. By the way, there's only a handful of trillion-dollar companies.
The question is like—
I take the over.
there's four trillion-dollar companies.
Yes, so one of them. But the point was, why would he care about what we do? And I think what the challenge is that— just because a CEO says it doesn't mean it translates into the business.
Sure.
And when you have a growth mandate, like it's not a mindset problem. It's a system problem. My big to bigger machine, my efficiency optimization machine, is literally at war with growth because it's going to increment.
How many So
he needs a bone drill is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And we're that bone drill.
But let me ask you a question. If I were managing a trillion-dollar company or a company that's worth a couple hundred billion only, like,
ten would be
why wouldn't I just buy you? How many clients have offered to buy you?
Does it always come up? I think some would want to buy us and could very well buy us. That would surprise you if I told you who they are.
Yep.
We're kind of like just starting to get those signals, implicit and explicit signals.
Got it.
And I think for the partners like the big four in the world, the big players, they can't be us, and we have no interest in being them. So
it's like
a new vehicle that tracks an entirely different. Yep. We're like the beach for EIRs. Like if you're an entrepreneur, you sell your company, you're like, let's say you're not post-economic, you're like, all right, I want to figure out what I'm doing next.
Yeah.
If I am rare and I get a seat at the table of a VC fund, I'm kind of trapped in that deal flow. In this case, I can coach doing the skill why upgrade my own.
Also, with all these, how many clients do you have now? How many customers do you
have? About
10. Yeah, so I mean, logically, these ones that are having this firsthand experience with you and your team are potential likely buyers. David, one thing that we didn't talk about that I feel like we'd miss out if we didn't ask is just about leadership and hiring and
good point.
Team. And you and I have talked, I'm going to kind of butcher this, but I remember one of our breakfasts, by the way, if you ever want to catch up with them 7 in the morning, you'll get them every single time outside of 7, no dice. But I remember you talked about kind of a leadership offsite and some special dynamics about the team and how the team talks and that sort of thing. But I want to just understand you as a leader and how you hire people and who you are in the office. We didn't get a chance with our superpowers sort of infrastructure to go pull a lot of people. But can you talk a little bit about your philosophy?
I would say my philosophy is really centered on this concept called becoming, which came from my uncle who died in 2014. And he was 7 years old and he sold this company. There's a theme here, by the way. When you stop working, I think the universe sort of takes you back. And so in the case of David, who retired very young and passed away.
Interesting.
And for Roger.
I'll never stop working.
I think the whole concept of retirement is actually foolish. Mm-hmm. In fact, I might actually go after that idea conceptually in the marketplace in the next couple of years. I think it's a terrible, terrible idea.
Interesting.
Anyways, so.
We should write a book on that together.
I'm serious. Like, I'm almost anti the whole concept. I think it's. So Roger, he got stage 4 glioblastoma. This is my mentor, started me as an entrepreneur when I was 16. Sold his company, passed away 9 months later. And on his deathbed, he told me, he's like, you know, don't focus on who you are to the world, focus on who you're becoming. So in that tearful moment where, you know, we said we're together forever, I walked away and was like, what does that even mean? Mm-hmm. And what he was saying is that to the point I was making earlier, when you get to the top, there's like literally nothing there. Like there's no amount of money. There's no career success. There's no second person. It doesn't really matter. Like it's all about falling in love with the grind, in the bottom of the valley. It's the learning. It's the tests. It's the ugliness of it. You know, and if you can't get your spirit into like learning how to learn from that, you're going to be really, really dissatisfied with the choice you make in your life. And so for me, becoming has been central. And so the question is, how do you become? So as a leader, I really think about the idea of deep discovery. So this goes to your question of like, how do you know you're good at something? So purpose is, passion's one, but the obsession point I'm trying to drive to is that if you're most successful when you most deeply care, the question is, what do you most deeply care about? Mm. And so I feel like raising my sons, I am not raising excellent sheep. I'm trying to help them make decisions in their life that lead them to that answer when they can ask, why me? What's my proprietary gift? My obsession to solve that problem. That to me is a life that has longevity. But so in the deep discovery piece, I have this model in my mind I share with others, which is our reality, our life really is a reflection of our choices, right? And choices are really all intentional. Mm-hmm. And so whether you know it or not, your choice is an intentional choice.
Yeah.
If you don't know why you make those intentions, you can't answer why is my life the way it is. You're walking around like a zombie with a bunch of habits coded into yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So once you figure out why you intentionally make those choices that lead to your reality, what you find out underneath the why is really only one of two choices, and that is love or fear. Mm. And so the question is, can you understand the intention where you can choose abundance of love and not fear, which means you have to be in dialogue both passively and actively in a conversation with yourself, which to me is a model of my observer self to myself in the world, that creates integration. So I'm no longer a zombie with habits. I'm now in conversation with my eternal self, with that person, physical person, that allows me to make good choices. And so I can't really choose my life different in who I'm becoming unless I know why. That's the discovery part. The second one is just, the second part of becoming is just permission to set down an old truth, right? That doesn't have to be true about whoever etched it into your heart. You'll never be, you'll always be. The taxonomy, right. That's the hard, the firmware. So allowing yourself to understand the code that is you, because you've done the deep work, set it down so that you are in a position to say, I can write it. It's my code, and I can make the intentional choice. And the last thing is, apprehension, is just a belief. It's about, like, what exactly do you believe about your future with conviction that pulls you through?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the most difficult times I've had when I've gone through true brokenness, like my last, you know, Clickable really hurt me because –
yeah.
It didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I, one night, when my friend David Smith called me, he was our chief revenue officer, and he said this to me. He goes, why are you making this so hard? And I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, this is about you. This is about your ego, your brand, your success, this company. He's like, you're not allowing anybody to help you in this journey. Not the universe, not God, not anybody. This is all about you. And so the more you demand from this, the less people can help. And he goes, someday you have to give it over. And I was literally like, what does that even mean? And he's like, give it over to the universe, give it over to God. And I was like, what does that mean? He's like, you have to accept all the outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And my response was, I was like, you mean failure? He goes, public failure. And my next line was, you mean insider.com? He goes, front page. And I literally, I was in my young 30s, and I laid down in the attic of that yellow house, and I literally flat on the ground, and I cried my eyes out.
Wow.
It broke me.
Wow.
But I gave it over. And I accepted all the outcomes. And I went to bed at night and I slept.
Yeah,
and I came back energized.
But by the way, like, there's a lot of people who would not consider that a failure. Like,
it's a win. But I the reason why it's so powerful is that I now was released from it. And I still worked just as hard, but I wasn't living in fear.
Right.
Yeah.
And a month later, Michael calls me out of the blue, literally, and says, do you want to be acquired? And I was like, yes, I do. And I was out in a month.
Yeah.
And so in that work, that becoming concept really renewed me from that journey.
By the way, so when you walk into your office, is there a big sign that says becoming?
No. It's part of our playbook. It's our philosophy.
Got it.
Would you say pretty consistently that how many employees was it? 20 plus?
We have about 55.
50, sorry. 20 50 rev. 20 mil rev. I got those mixed up.
I'm the numbers guy in this.
Would you say, David, I'd imagine a lot of those employees have a very – there is a cultural aspect within Bionic that I imagine, whether it's at the water cooler or through the recruiting process, which is probably unconventional, I'm just assuming.
Yeah.
I imagine a lot of these kind of pillars are shared.
Yeah, very much so. I'm very public about it, very vulnerable inside the context of that. I haven't really gone outside the walls, but listen, we go through our struggles. When we're going through right now, we're like fixing the business and making it work and making changes. And like it's every company goes through that. And I think my failure in my leadership has been not bringing the full truth always the tale because, like, I got it, and it's a straight line. There's no plan B. And I think that has been something that what has trapped me as a leader has been that I haven't brought the full truth always because I don't want them to worry.
Yeah.
But in reality, if I'm willing to underwrite the cost, that's fine. But if I'm asking them to underwrite the cost with me.
Yeah.
Have you been guilty? I've been guilty of that.
100%. Listen.
And even right now.
100%. So many times I actually say I am doing them a favor by not telling them X, Y, and Z. And I am guilty as charged for this.
So
like I hold so much stuff back.
I think it's
I feel like I'm more transparent.
Yeah.
Than most, but you know, at the end of the day, I always feel like there's a big difference between number one and number two. Like it's, and there's certain things that you got to shoulder and you got to deal with, and sometimes you know. Yeah. But I may have a laying down in my living room
tonight. David. So we positioned this as a Superpowers podcast show.
Yep.
It's really a mask for Bill and I, sort of psychology, therapy session.
By the way, we just have guests so that we don't have to pay psychologists.
Yeah, exactly. So let me tell you, I'll tell you this last thing, which is the renewal part of this whole thing. So what kind of led me to Bionic, this whole thing, was this moment. So this is all sort of groundwork, and I'm kind of bridging two stories, the beginning and then this renewal thing I just went through. But
the beginning meaning you like cracking your glasses while riding a bike?
Well, there's that too, but that's a huge corpus of like a life. But I was going to say, after that experience of selling the company and sort of renewing, I had this moment, this visual moment where I just felt like I was like running like through the thorns. I was just getting ripped apart. It's just like I've been at 35 years of, you know, or 20 and as an entrepreneur, you know, 80-hour weeks, you know, and people don't realize that for 15, 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm not more successful. And where's the mountaintop? Like, when am I going to get there?
Right.
And that's what let me down. But more importantly is I started to really not believe it anymore. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, maybe I'm not good at this. Like, maybe I should get a job. Maybe I'm not a good entrepreneur. Maybe I suck at being a CEO. It turns out, like, we all suck at being a CEO.
Yeah.
Like, ran on a curve, as Ben says, like, we'd all get, like, a 25% mm-hmm. score. We need to change our expectation of the mm-hmm. journey. I had this night where I just imagined myself in these thorns running, you know, and I literally kind of just made a decision. I was like, I'm going to start over. I lifted myself out of that stupidly painful psychological place, and I put myself on a clean road. But I started that road intentionally when I was 20. And I felt incredibly foolish and naive. And then I was like, but I recommitted to all the same things I believe about the future as if I were 20 again. Because what does it matter?
Yeah.
All the same things are true to the extent I have conviction in them. Whether I was 40 or 20, it didn't really matter. The point is, like, did I have the courage to re-up?
Yeah.
And that moment was when I was like, I'm going to start over. But I'm going to start over right in here. But I have to say, it was literally the scariest thing I ever did in my life because it felt unwise. Mm. But it was actually incredibly powerful to do it because it allowed me to begin again.
Yeah.
Clean. And that moment and then all these things that come from it has just given me a permission to not judge myself.
Mm-hmm.
Not be the one shooting the arrows in my life about what I was good or not. And just I just set it all down and just started over. And it's really what's behind Bionica now is that journey is just creating the permission to re-believe, and that becoming really frames the work that has allowed people to start over.
I think there's so many people that would love to be able to lay out this, what you did, and the ability to sort of, you know, give permission and to be, you know, that's just not a normal characteristic because everyone sort of, you know, we live in a society which is, you know, I'm crushing it and everything's great and I'm going to get there. So this is
I'm the opposite of I have tremendous respect for Gary and his movements and stuff. I'm kind of the opposite of crushing it. I think it's a narrative that motivates people, but I really focus on the opposite narrative, which is like, okay, this is what it feels like to like not crush it. And it's not a versus or better.
Right.
It's just like there's a whole other story here.
Well, how many people learn things from not crushing it versus if you're just crushing it, you're not learning.
Well, I think Gary is very he's the real deal. Like he's honest, he's very vulnerable. I have tremendous
it's the positivity aspect that's just so endearing.
Yeah, and it's by the way, it's totally authentic. I think what I'd say that for the vulnerability side would be where I think I really put it out there. I think where I'm going as a leader is to put it all out there.
Yeah.
Because the problem, the trap I've created in my career has been there's some things that I will only hold. The buck stops here, but I'm going to hold it like this. Because what that happens, and I think it's true in my own personal life, which is if I don't bring people into the responsibility to share with me in the journey or contribute, they can't help you.
Right.
You're selfish.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, they're powerless. And then you and they are alone. And when it goes sideways, they get angry for you not bringing the full truth.
Right. Oh, it's too late at that time.
It's too late.
All right. So here's the deal, guys.
Okay.
We could speak for hours. And I happen to be a terrible listener, but I find myself like listening on every word that he says.
I've said four words the whole hour. I mean, I'm just like every time.
It's
in a good way. No,
in a great way. So now is the time of the podcast. We've got to wrap things up, and we have to talk about your superpower. I'll do a slight recap. Let's jump in there whenever you want. So it's been an absolute pleasure. You know, every time I listen to you, you just have such a different perspective, and I take something away every time we meet. And so for that, thank you. And that's a gift.
Well, I love you guys.
It's a gift, but it's not your superpower. Yeah. So, you know, from way upstate New York, delivering papers and getting, you know, cracking your glasses on your face, to where you are now.
Don't forget about the Teddy. Don't forget about
the blender.
Yeah.
I forgot all that.
By the way, I know I totally.
I'm going to get a text later, which is like, you're welcome.
By the way, I already know what I'm getting for him for next year's
lunch. $1,000 blender?
Yeah.
No cord?
Anyway, so.
Wireless?
So, I mean, a New York Times bestseller. You know, you are good at everything. You're not good at not hitting the microphone. You hit it like 20 times.
Sorry.
Yep.
So that is not your superpower.
Nope.
You have had more conversations with people on their deathbed than I've ever heard anyone.
Yep. Unfortunately,
you know,
yes.
So that's unfortunate. But I also feel like
also that, a gift.
Like, yeah, it's a gift. But your actual superpower, in my perspective, is the fact that you act on your obsessions,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like you and your obsessions, you internalize and they're passionate obsessions,
yeah.
right? I don't know if, you know, and so like the ability for like, and I almost feel like it's like a, it's an itch that you can't stop scratching. Mm-hmm. Once you become obsessed, you go all in on that obsession
mm-hmm.
and like driving to solve problems towards that obsession. And you've done it like no one I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And sometimes those obsessions can be way out there, like bionic, you know, or like writing a book when you, you know. And so I think acting on an obsession is your superpower.
That's kind. Thank you,
Bill. Bill continues to crush in this good context of summaries. I mean, this has been one of the harder ones as I've kind of had to sort of think about how to dissect the conversation. I'll echo the fact that I'm just so grateful that you're a friend and in our lives, because more David Kidders is just better for everybody. So I'm going to try to distill everything, which is super difficult, and I'm going to go with fearless, because I think most people, including myself, there's always a fear to the other side. There's fear to what people think. There's fear to admit in failure. There's fear. You have a fearlessness combined with the fact that you seem to understand humans better than most, and you're willing to share. So it's like this perfect trifecta of the openness, the willingness to share is what I believe is your superpower. But fearlessness is definitely what I heard over this last hour that I'm going to kind of land on, along with Bill's summary.
Well, yeah. Very kind. It's an honor to be here. I love both you guys and know you for a long time and expect to for the rest of our lives, and but thank you, very kind.
So for all those people listening,
you're welcome.
Watching,
you're welcome.
Go buy the Intellectual Devotional; it's outstanding. Put it next to your toilet. In fact, put it next to every single one of your toilets, which is why it's the number one book in Japan.
Number
right
one.
Now.
And if you like this episode, maybe share with a friend.
Sure.
Share. Put it out. Superpowers. David Kidder. Such a pleasure. Thanks for joining
us. Very kind.
Thanks.
Superpowers.